Hey y'all, Darius Rucker here. You know, a lot of people ask me, what inspires your music? And one of the big things is a strong sense of place. That's why I love my home state of South Carolina and want to share the awesome things it has to offer. From the beautiful mountains down to the sunny coast, it's got it all. Not to mention two of my personal favorites, great golf and amazing food. Come see why I love this place. Visit discoversouthcarolina.com.
Most tax pros leave a message.
It's Jane. I'm moving on to a TurboTax expert who beat your price. Adam Devine, tell him how I feel.
Hey, tax pro, she's been thinking twice. Best believe TurboTax will beat your price.
This is a tax break.
Switch to a TurboTax live expert and we'll beat what you paid your pro last tax season. Make the switch at TurboTax.com/beat your price. TurboTax full service only. Sign up by 12/20/2024 and file by 4/1/2025. Full details at TurboTax.com/beat your price.
Hello, potboys and pyromancers, knights and tavern wenches, and welcome back to another Still Smug Book Talk section, this week covering Season 6, Episode 8, entitled No One. It's me, your host, Sir Duncan the Fearsome, Lord of Castle Stirling and bearer of the Valyrian Steel Greatsword, Dark Warrior. And this week, as ever, we have some fun A Song of Ice and Fire book crossover material to cover. If you haven't read the book series from which Game of Thrones is based, and don't want to be spoiled with material that could range through all 5 books that have been released thus far, this is your chance to skip this bonus episode and avoid irreversible spoiler damage. Book perspective coverage begins in 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And we're off. This week's first book crossover is the appearance of Milk of the Poppy when Arya is given a glass by Lady Crane, the actress. This scene doesn't happen in the books, and we're further along in the TV show with Arya's plotline than we are in the books right now, but I felt like I should mention Milk of the Poppy showing up on the TV show because it's pretty rare on the show, and in the books it's kind of a regular staple of everyday life in Westeros. The mountain's on Milk of the Poppy all the time, everybody's getting Milk of the Poppy for some kind of ailment or another, so I thought it deserved a little mention here at the start. If I remember correctly, the mountain actually quaffs Milk of the Poppy like ale. And that is hardcore. And the next book crossover that we have is the return of the Brotherhood Without Banners. This time they are seen interacting with the Hound, which is awesome. Book readers have been speculating how the Hound would behave when he returned, assuming that he was the grave digger from the Quiet Isle. And here he does not disappoint. He is slashing and hacking with his axe, cutting out people's genitals, smashing their heads, cutting them right off. Oh man. The Hound is vicious and ruthless, and he is not afraid of anything. He had a great line here where he asks the bald guy, where's the other guy with the yellow cloak? You know, the one who helped you destroy the Sept and kill all those people. And the guy, what does he say? He says, fuck you. So the Hound says, oh, those are your last words? Really? You could do better than that. So the guy goes, cunt. And the Hound responds, you're shit at dying, you know that? Which is hilarious because you know the Hound has seen dozens and dozens of people die as a direct result of his sword, axe, hands, whatever implement of destruction he has at the moment. So if he tells you you're shit at dying, it's probably true. He's probably heard lots more cool last words than that. Try harder, bruh. So the Hound finally catches up with the guy in the yellow cloak. Book readers will be happy to know that this is confirmed as Lem Lemoncloak, and sad to know that Lem Lemoncloak is dead pretty much immediately. This is a cool character from the books that you guys will remember, and I had brought up speculation last week about how he could have been Rhaegar's squire, I believe it was, the Knight of Skulls and Kisses, who may know Jon Snow's true heritage. But unfortunately, it doesn't look like he'll be sharing that knowledge with anybody at all in show canon, as he is soon killed by the Hound. This is actually very interesting because the first guy we see from the Brotherhood that we recognize is Beric Dondarrion. And book readers know that in the books, Beric had given his life to breathe the fire of R'hllor into Lady Stoneheart, into Catelyn Stark to revive her from the dead. days after the Red Wedding, when the Brotherhood stumbled upon her bloated corpse in the river by the twins. So the appearance of Beric leads me to believe that Lady Stoneheart may not be making a show appearance. You'd imagine at this point that she would be around and Beric would be gone if events had played out the same way in the book, considering it's years at this point after the Red Wedding, and Catelyn Stark would have been brought back just days after the fact. They kind of tricked us last week when we saw the Brotherhood without banners sort of behaving ruthlessly and in a different manner than we'd come to expect based on their appearances in Season 2 when they first showed up. And a lot of book readers especially, had attributed this to a potential change of leadership, which would have occurred when Beric died and Lady Catelyn was brought back to life. Interestingly, as you guys all know, Lady Catelyn is more of a spirit of vengeance at that point, and pretty much focuses her return on killing Freys and getting judgment for these bad guys who perpetrated the Red Wedding, murdering her, her son, her son's wife, her son's wife's unborn baby, and their armies, and Direwolf. So sadly, at this point, it looks like Lady Stoneheart will not be making an appearance, but the silver lining is that Beric Dondarrion is still around, and that guy is a badass. Super cool to see him back on the screen, and I am happy to see the return of the band... I always call them the Band of Brothers, the Brotherhood Without Banners. Now, interestingly, we find out some information about what the Brotherhood with Banners are up to at this point that may set the tone for the books as well. And hopefully the storyline in the books will include the Hound like it is in the show. But basically, you know, despite the first time they met and the way they didn't get along, the Brotherhood Without Banners are trying to sort of recruit the Hound at this point. You know, they're saying, we're part of something larger than just ourselves, and we need big badasses like you, essentially, to come join us in our fight. There's a cold wind rising in the north. You know, good and bad, young and old, the things we're fighting will destroy them all. You can still help a lot more than you've harmed. Now, if you remember in my Still Smug exclusive Book Talk bonus episode that was released last week, I mentioned a few different ways that people had speculated about Jon Snow being revived up at the Wall. And if the Brotherhood Without Banners on the show are going to be headed north to fight in the battle against the Whites and White Walkers, that could indicate that in the books, they're going to be heading north as well. Except what's the main difference in the books? Instead of Beric leading them, they still have Lady Stoneheart leading them in the books. So, if they're going north, maybe bringing the Hound with them, that opens up the door for Catelyn Stark or Lady Stoneheart to potentially sacrifice her own life to bring back Jon, who has been recently murdered at the Wall. I would find this to be a very compelling storyline, simultaneously a redemption for Lady Catelyn for treating Jon so badly after she realizes who he really is, the true heir to the Iron Throne after Rhaegar and Aerys, and it would be a satisfying conclusion to the Lady Stoneheart arc, I believe, resurrecting Jon Snow as Azor Ahai and ending Catelyn Stark once and for all. And based on the way that Sandor is reacting at the end of the scene there before it cuts, I would not be surprised if he ends up joining the Brotherhood Without Banners, which would be awesome. It'd be great to see him fighting side by side with those guys. And can you imagine the Hound taking on a White Walker? Or a group of like 10 Whites with a flaming sword or a, you know, some type of epic weapon. And not only that, going north may offer the Hound opportunities beyond a fresh start, fighting for good, and a clean slate. Sansa Stark is north, and the Hound has had previous interactions with Sansa to quite an extent. Book readers are familiar with the people who ship Sansa and the Hound as a couple, a potential pair, and they've had quite a number of romantic interactions in the past that would lead this to be a possibility. Sandor the Hound, this ruthless guy, has always seemed to have a soft spot for Sansa Stark from the first time they met. Shortly after, he saved her from a mob of potential rapists when Joffrey's group was assaulted on the streets of King's Landing. When Sansa was being stripped by Joffrey and the King's Guard, Tyrion showed up, put an end to it, and it was the Hound that gave her his cloak to cover her naked self up. Aside from that, The Hound has bared his soul to Sansa repeatedly. There was that time when he was walking her back from the King's Tourney, or one of the tournaments, and he told her the story of how his brother burned his face. And after the Battle of Blackwater Bay, which resulted in Sandor becoming an even more broken man after being exposed to the flames of wildfire, which left him traumatized and, you know, brought up those memories from being burned as a child, just ripping open those scars, all brand new and fresh. Where did he end up? He ended up waiting in Sansa Stark's bedchambers. And when she showed up, he offered to rescue her and sweep her away out of the city and bring her to safety. She turned him down, but she ended up singing him a little song, and he went on his way, leaving his bloody Kingsguard cloak behind for her. This is actually a fascinating scene, which contains material that people may not have realized on a simple read-through. It seems that in that scene, Sansa may have actually cast a spell on Sandor inadvertently, which she did by singing him that prayer. For once, a prayer in the name of Seven seems to have actually come true to some degree in A Song of Ice and Fire. Now, if you go by the Gravedigger theory, it seems that Sandor's rage may have actually been calmed to some degree following his interaction with Sansa in that scene. He ended up being let go by the Brotherhood Without Banners, who deemed that R'hllor had more use for him. He survived his encounter with Arya after being bitten by Biter, and now he seems to have found peace at the Quiet Isle with the Brotherhood of Monks that are stationed there. And even on the show, he's not quite as venom-filled as he was previously. He even said on the episode that there was a day where I would have killed all seven of you brothers, you know, to get to these three hanging on by the ropes there. Thoros of Myr had a funny reply where he said, "You're getting old, Sandor," which was pretty cool. But I want to go into a little bit more detail about this prayer that Sansa said to Sandor and the effects that it may have had. Considering Sandor may be on his way north to meet up with Sansa again, I think this is pretty significant. And so my first reading tonight will be the passage from Sansa's bedchambers. So here we go. The blood masked the worst of his scars, but his eyes were white and wide and terrifying. The burnt corner of his mouth twitched and twitched again. Sansa could smell him, a stink of sweat and sour wine and stale vomit, and over it all the reek of blood, blood, blood. "I could keep you safe," he rasped. "They're all afraid of me. No one would hurt you again, or I'd kill them." He yanked her closer, and for a moment, she thought he meant to kiss her. He was too strong to fight. She closed her eyes, wanting it to be over, but nothing happened. "Still can't bear to look, can you?" she heard him say. He gave her arm a hard wrench, pulling her around and shoving her down onto the bed. "I'll have that song. Florian and Jonquil, you said." His dagger was out, poised at her throat. "Sing, little bird. Sing for your little life." Her throat was dry and tight with fear. Every song she had ever known had fled from her mind. "Please don't kill me," she wanted to scream. "Please don't." She could feel him twisting the point, pushing it into her throat, and she almost closed her eyes again, but then she remembered. It was not the song of Florian and Jonquil, but it was a song. Her voice sounded small and thin and tremulous in her ears. "Gentle mother, font of mercy, save our sons from war, we pray. Stay the swords and stay the arrows, let them know a better day. Gentle mother, strength of women, help our daughters through this fray. Soothe the wrath and tame the fury, teach us all a kinder way." She had forgotten the other verses. When her voice trailed off, she feared he might kill her. But after a moment, the Hound took the blade from her throat, never speaking. Some instinct made her lift her hand and cup his cheek with her fingers. The room was too dark for her to see him, but she could feel the stickiness of the blood and a wetness that was not blood.
"Little bird,"
he said once more, his voice raw and harsh as steel on stone. Then he rose from the bed. Sansa heard cloth ripping, followed by the softer sound of retreating footsteps. When she crawled out of bed, Long moments later, she was alone. She found his cloak on the floor, twisted up tight, the white wool stained by blood and fire. So as you can see, there's some elements of romance here occurring between Sansa and the Hound at various different occasions. I really think it will be great to see them back together on screen, and can't wait to see what happens between these two. Okay, let's move along. Next book crossover that we have isn't quite a crossover, but it's more of a situation that can be analyzed from a book perspective that may relate to a book crossover. And this is Varys leaving Meereen on a secret mission to find friends for Daenerys. Now, where could Varys be going? He could be going to the Iron Fleet, but they're already heading to him. Some people speculate that he may be going to Dorne, which could be a substitute for the Quentin Martell plot that we got in the books. This would be a way for Daenerys to get the Dornish on her side and continue to build her army for her invasion of the Seven Kingdoms. In the books, the plan was for her to land in Dorne if relations had gone well with Quentin and start the takeover from there. So it'll be interesting to see how this plays out on the show. If she can ally with the Dornish, at this point the Sand Snakes, which wouldn't be surprising considering they're a group of strong women who would only be happy to see another strong woman in a position of power, It'll be interesting to see how that plays out. I could see it happening. Next, we jump back over to King's Landing, where the Mountain finally gets some action. Book readers have been anticipating this for years, knowing that Robert Strong is a total badass, but not having seen him do anything yet. So, it was awesome to see him doing something again and ripping a dude's head off, just straight off his shoulders. It was also really cool to see how one of those sparrows came up with like a pointed warhammer with four big spikes on it. It looks like a stupid little simple weapon, but that's actually a pretty good weapon, it seems, for puncturing plate armor, as it left four holes in the Mountain's armor and probably would have severely injured a regular human. But as you could see, the Mountain was unfazed by this quadruple puncture and proceeded to lift this guy up by the neck and then rip his head off. Awesome to see. Can't wait to see more of this. Book readers rejoice. Next, we have an interesting event that occurs in the books under very different circumstances, and this is the reuniting of Brienne and Jaime. Now, as you know, Brienne was captured by Lady Stoneheart and her crew, the Brotherhood Without Banners, and basically was given two options: die at the end of a rope, or bring Jaime Lannister for his punishment at the end of a rope. And at the end of the chapter, right as Brienne is about to be hung and Podrick is dangling by his neck, Brienne lets out a cry and says one word. The chapter ends, but we end up coming face to face with Brienne again in a future Jaime chapter when she rides up on Jaime in the Riverlands and they ride off together. We still don't know what happens with that situation in the books, but it's safe to say that nothing good is going to come of that, or at least it doesn't seem that way. I really hope that Jaime and Brienne both get out unscathed from that, because they're both great characters, and Jaime is in the process of his redemption. It'd just be a shame to see him cut down before that happens. But here we go on the TV show, and they're reunited under entirely different circumstances. Instead of being sent by Catelyn Stark, this time Brienne is sent by her daughter, Sansa, and she is not sent to find Jaime. She's sent to River Run to recruit the Blackfish and the Tully army, but she stumbles upon Jaime and uses it to her advantage in this situation. Interestingly, we find out in this scene that Jaime never expected Brienne to find Sansa, or so he says. He assumed that she was already dead at that point. They go on to get in a little bit of an argument, and Jaime says, you know, we shouldn't argue about politics. These two have a great dynamic, and you can tell they both really care about each other, and you never see Jaime being this compassionate with anybody, really. So it's just heartbreaking to see them together, but on different sides of this battle. Brienne holds out Oathkeeper and offers it back to Jaime, saying that the mission that he gave it to her for was completed and that she's returning it to him. And Jamie, of course, tells her that Oathkeeper belongs to her and that it will always be hers. This is a very emotional moment for me, at least. I assume that other people were hit hard by this. But I've heard speculation since then that this could be more of a symbolic encounter as well. That Brienne trying to give Oathkeeper back to Jaime may signify a turning point in Jaime's arc, representing a choice for Jaime to choose keeping oaths and being an honorable person, or breaking oaths and taking a turn away from redemption towards a negative arc in the direction that he would be going with Cersei. I hope that this isn't symbolic of that, and that Jaime does end up, you know, going on a more redemptive path. But shortly after that, he is threatening to fling babies over River Run with a trebuchet. So we'll see how that goes. But I'll get more into that in a little bit. So this was nice, as people have been long anticipating the reconnection of Jaime and Brienne, but it really only gets more heartbreaking from here. Brienne stops on her way out of Jaime's tent and basically says, "Listen, if I can't convince the Blackfish to ride north and you're forced to attack, honor compels me to fight on the side of Sansa's kin. This means that I'll be fighting against you." And you can see a sort of twitch in Jaime's face at this moment, where his strong exterior facade cracks, and you can see he's really torn by this. Really brutal scene. He tells her, "You know, I understand. Let's hope it doesn't come to that." And I really hope it doesn't come to that, because I like these characters a lot, and it would just be so sad to see them torn apart, or to see Bran kill Jaime, or something like that. It would just be horrible. So I really hope that nothing like that ends up happening. I know, Tormund Giantsbane is in the picture now, who likes Brienne, which seems to have been added to the story to make up for the fact that Jaime is still going gaga over Cersei, which is very different in the books at this point. But I still like Jaime and Brienne, and I would be happy if something positive happened with them. Like if Brienne ended up being a positive influence on Jaime, whereas Cersei is a negative influence, and Jaime ends up choosing good over evil because of the influence that Brienne had on him. Jaime may have turned down Oathkeeper in this instance, but I'm hoping that does not also mean that he's chosen a path of dishonor. He's still got a lot that he can do in terms of good in this world, and hopefully soon he'll have some opportunities to really do it. But, of course, that's cast into doubt almost immediately as he goes to meet with Edmure Tully. This is another great crossover from the books that many of you will remember, his famous trebuchet, or trebuchet, speech that he gives to Edmure, threatening the life of his child if he doesn't decide to surrender River Run to the Lannister forces. I really liked this scene on the show, and it had some interesting dialogue that was show unique, but also brought in some really good references from the books. I thought it was pretty potent. You know, Edmure asks Jaime, like, "Really, I want to know, how do you live with yourself? Everyone has to, you know, believe that they're decent, don't we, when to sleep at night. How do you tell yourself you're decent after everything you've done?" And again, you can see Jaime's strong facade crack for a moment as he's torn, you know, between good and evil, between honor and dishonor, remembering his horrible past and considering the options for his future. What will he do from here? Will he choose a path of honor? Will he choose a path of destruction and violence? Jaime brings up Catelyn, Edmure's sister, and compares her to Cersei, interestingly. You know, they both were strong females who would do anything to protect their babies, including, he says, start wars, burn cities to ash, and free their worst enemies. As you know, Catelyn freed her worst enemy, Jaime, who pushed her son from a window, on the off chance that this Oathbreaker, Kingslayer, may choose honor for once and return her daughters to her, Arya and Sansa, who were supposedly being held captive in King's Landing. Unfortunately, Jaime couldn't do that, but he did the best he could, which included outfitting Brienne for the task and sending her on the mission. I thought it was a great little line that he threw in there also. He says, you know, they'll do anything to protect their babies, start wars, burn cities to ash, free their worst enemies. The things we do for love, he said, which, as you remember, was the exact sentence he used before he threw Bran out the window, or pushed him out the window, back in the pilot episode. Keen observers may have been noticing that Jaime was angling at something by bringing up, you know, the things that people will do to save their children. He mentions to Edmure that he has a son whom he hasn't seen yet, and a wife as well who he hasn't seen since his wedding. He says, you know, you two should be together, but that's only going to happen if you surrender River Run. I'm gonna let you go, and you're going to go back to the Blackfish, and you're going to enter that castle, and you're going to surrender it. Otherwise, I'm going to send for your wife, send for your kid, and I'm going to send your son flying over the walls of River Run with a trebuchet if you refuse to surrender the castle. And one thing I found really cool about this scene is that as Jaime is delivering this monologue to Edmure, threatening his child if he refuses to give up his castle, his face is shrouded half in darkness, half perfectly lit, half perfectly dark. And to me, this represents the dichotomy of Jaime's his mental position. He's in a position where he has to choose between light and dark. He can be honorable or dishonorable, and he's caught right in the middle. So it's a good thing that Edmure decides to obey and surrender River Run, because I don't think Jaime wants to have to go down that dark path. At his soul, I think, at his core, I think he's a good guy, and he wants to be honorable and do the right thing. And he doesn't like being in this type of position, I don't think. And Edmure, you know, makes the decision that he thinks is right, which is to try to save his son, try to save his wife, and try to reunite with them by submitting to the Lannister demands, essentially. He crosses over the bridge and immediately demands that the forces stand down and that they open the gates for the Lannisters. Now, book readers recognize this scenario from the books. This is pretty much exactly what happens. Edmure is released as a hostage into River Run, and the castle is surrendered. But in this process, in the books, the Blackfish disappears. He swims out through the gates, under the gates, and down the river in the cover of darkness, and escapes, and his location is still unknown in the books at this point. So I imagine that book readers were shocked and disappointed as well when he refused to get on that boat with Brienne of Tarth and Podrick Payne. After waiting for so long for the Blackfish to come back and having so much potential for how he could affect the story in the books and the show, I think a lot of people were probably crushed that he didn't even get a death on screen in this episode. We were just told he's dead and didn't get to see him fight, didn't get to see any of that. I mean, from the show perspective, it's understandable because the actor is in his late 70s, I believe. So it wouldn't really make sense to have him doing a lot, like a few days worth of shooting high intensity action scenes. But it would have been nice to see the Blackfish do a little bit more before he ended up being killed off. And next, I would like to read another passage from the book. This time, I'll be reading Jaime's trebuchet passage. So just to set the scene, he is sending for Edmure Tully, current captive of the Freys, and he is planning on bringing him across the bridge to River Run to free him in exchange for certain terms. So, without any further ado, Jaime waved his golden hand. Sir Lyle, bring him. Edmure Tully had collapsed face down on the scaffold when Sir Ilan's blade sheared the rope in two. A foot of hemp still dangled from the noose about his neck. Strongbore grabbed the end of it and pulled him to his feet. "A fish on a leash," he said, chortling. "There's a sight I never saw before." The Freys stepped aside to let them pass. A crowd had gathered below the scaffold, including a dozen camp followers in various states of disarray. Jamie noticed one man holding a wood harp. "You, singer, come with me." The man doffed his hat. "As my lord commands." No one said a word as they walked back to the ferry, with Sir Ryman's singer trailing after them. But as they shoved off from the riverbank and made for the south side of the Tumblestone, Edmure Tully grabbed Jaime by the arm. "Why?" "A Lannister pays his debts," he thought, "and you're the only coin that's left to me. Consider it a wedding gift." Edmure stared at him with wary eyes. A wedding gift? "I'm told your wife is pretty." "She'd have to be for you to bed her while your sister and your king were being murdered." "I never knew," Edmure licked his crackling lips. "There were fiddlers outside the bedchamber, and Lady Roslyn was distracting you." "They made her do it, Lord Walder and the rest. Roslyn never wanted. She wept, but I thought it was the sight of your rampant manhood. Aye, that would make any woman weep, I'm sure." "She's carrying my child." "No," Jamie thought. "That's your death she has growing in her belly." Back at his pavilion, he dismissed Strongbore and Sir Ilan, but not the singer. "I may have need of the song shortly," he told the man. "Lou, heat some bath water for my guest. Pia, find him some clean clothing. Nothing with lions on it, if you please. Peck, wine for Lord Tully. Are you hungry, my lord?" Edmure nodded, but his eyes were still suspicious. Jamie settled on a stool while Tully had his bath. The filth came off in gray clouds. "Once you've eaten, my men will escort you to River Run. What happens after that is up to you."
"What do you mean?"
"Your uncle is an old man. Valiant, yes. But the best part of his life is done. He has no bride to grieve for him, no children to defend. A good death is all the Blackfish can hope for. But you have years remaining, Edmure, and you are the rightful lord of House Tully, not him. Your uncle serves at your pleasure. The fate of Riverrun is in your hands." Edmure stared.
"The fate of Riverrun?"
"Yield the castle and no one dies. Your small folk may go in peace or stay to serve Lord Emmon. Sir Brynden will be allowed to take the Black, along with as many of the garrison as choose to join him. You as well, if the wall appeals to you. Or you may go to Casterly Rock as my captive and enjoy all the comforts and courtesy that befits a hostage of your rank. I'll send your wife to join you, if you like. If her child is a boy, he will serve House Lannister as a page and a squire, and when he earns his knighthood, we'll bestow some lands upon him. Should Roslyn give you a daughter, I'll see her well dowered when she's old enough to wed. You yourself may even be granted parole once the war is done. All you need to do is yield the castle." Edmure raised his hands from the tub and watched the water run between his fingers.
"And if I will not yield?"
"Must you make me say the words?" Pia was standing by the flap of the tent with her arms full of clothes. His squires were listening as well, and the singer.
"Let them hear," Jamie thought. "Let the world hear. It makes no matter."
He forced himself to smile.
"You've seen our numbers, Edmure. You've seen the ladders, the towers, the trebuchets, the rams. If I speak the command, my cuz will bridge your moat and break your gate. Hundreds will die, most of them your own. Your former bannermen will make up the first wave of attackers, so you'll start your day by killing the fathers and brothers of the men who died for you at the Twins. The second wave will be Freys. I have no lack of those. My Westermen will follow when your archers are short of arrows and your knights are so weary they can hardly lift their blades. When the castle falls, all those inside will be put to the sword. Your herds will be butchered. Your godswood will be felled. Your keeps and towers will burn. I'll pull your walls down and divert the Tumblestone over the ruins. By the time I'm done, no man will ever know that a castle once stood here." Jamie got to his feet.
"Your wife may whelp before that. You'll want your child, I expect. I'll send him to you when he's born. With a trebuchet." Silence followed his speech.
Edmure sat in his bath. Pia clutched the clothing to her breasts. The singer tightened a string on his harp. Little Lou hollowed out a loaf of stale bread to make a trencher, pretending that he had not heard. With a trebuchet, Jamie thought. If his aunt had been there, would she still say Tyrion was Tywin's son? Edmure Tully finally found his voice.
I could climb out of this tub and kill you where you stand, Kingslayer.
You could try. Jamie waited. When Edmure made no move to rise, he said,
I'll leave you to enjoy your food.
Singer, play for our guest whilst he eats. You know the song, I trust. And that song would be The Reigns of Castamere, I'd be willing to bet. So, as you can see, these scenes play out fairly differently in the books and the show, but the same message gets across. Surrender, River Run, or I will catapult your baby at River Run. And you can tell the internal struggle in Jaime is present in this scene, as he's hesitant to say the words out loud with people in listening range. This isn't the person that Jaime wants to be. He doesn't want to kill kids. He doesn't want to do all this. You can tell in his heart he wants to be an honorable person. He killed King Aerys in the first place out of honor to prevent Aerys from slaughtering King's Landing as a whole and burning the city and all the people in it. What a tough position Jaime's in here. But while we're on the topic of burning the city as a whole and all the people in it, this brings us to Qyburn and Cersei. Another little book crossover we have here. If you make the connection to what Qyburn is hinting at, basically, after this scene where trial by combat is outlawed, which is also another really interesting twist that book readers may not have been expecting, Qyburn says to Cersei that those old rumors that you have told me about, I've investigated them. I've had my little birds look into them. When she asks about if they were true, he says, yes, they were. More than true. There's more here than you would have expected. So, what are they talking about? Do you guys have any ideas? I can think of one old rumor that may be at play here. And that would be the rumor of Mad Aerys having stashed wildfire all over the city. If you recall, in the episode after Hodor held the door, as Bran was being dragged away by Mira, there was a sequence of flashes of memories from the Weirwood tree, from memories from the past, visions from the future, all mingled together. We saw the Mad King yelling, burn them all. We saw Jon Snow killing a White Walker. We saw Ned asking, where's Lyanna? We saw pyromancers filling jars with wildfire, and we saw an explosion of wildfire from some type of chamber. Now, this didn't happen in the past because Jaime killed the pyromancer before he could, the head pyromancer, before he could tell the other pyromancers to light the wildfire. So this may have been a vision from the future. And there's been all kinds of little hints throughout this series of Cersei being willing to burn the city. There was a scene where she was talking to Tommen a few years ago and she said, I would burn this whole city to the ground before I'd let anything happen to you. Jaime said in this episode, remember what I mentioned a few minutes ago, that they would start wars, they would burn cities to ash, they would release their worst enemies to save their children. And there's that scene from the books, you might remember, where after Tyrion kills Tywin, Cersei has the Tower of the Hand burned to the ground with wildfire to try to get Tyrion out of it because she's convinced that he's holed up inside of it, just lurking and waiting for a moment to strike either against her or against Tommen or Jaime or anybody. But the point is, she's burning the tower and just gazing up in awe and joy as the green flames lick through the windows and the doors and the tower begins to melt and fall. And Jamie's kind of sitting there watching her like, who is this person? You look like the Mad King, just standing in awe watching the wildfire burn. And he was drawing comparisons between Cersei and Mad King Aerys at this moment in the books. So in this situation on the show, given the fact that we've seen flashes of wildfire exploding, given the fact that Jaime says in this episode that Cersei and Catelyn would have burned cities to ash to protect their children. And given these old rumors that Qyburn is mentioning, I think it's likely that Cersei has been investigating these old caches of wildfire supposedly left by the Mad King Aerys, and that she may be plotting to use them in some type of attack. This attack could be a targeted attack on the Sept of Baelor to try to wipe out the High Sparrow and his underlings, all the sparrows throughout the city. She could be, you know, wanting to get revenge on the whole city for jeering at her and throwing shit at her and spitting on her and throwing semen and pee and all this nasty stuff at her and calling her names and flashing their dicks at her and all this stuff when she was doing her shame walk. For all we know, Cersei could be planning to finish what the Mad King started and burn King's Landing to the ground, including everybody in it. Now, this would put Jaime in a very awkward position. Just imagine this. I mean, Jaime had sacrificed his honor and his reputation as, you know, he's one of the most promising knights, the most talented knights in all of Westeros and all of the Planetos. And he gave everything up, potentially, in that moment when he decided to kill King Aerys to prevent him from doing this exact thing. So how would he react if Cersei ended up doing it? The person who he loves the most would end up betraying him in the most awful way imaginable by completing the mission that he sacrificed his reputation to prevent in the first place. If, I mean, she could do it to try to save Tommen before he's, you know, put under too much influence by the High Sparrow, or if something happens and the prophecy that Maggie the Frog told Cersei ends up coming true and Tommen dies, it could be a retaliation. She might say, oh, I have nothing left to live for, and she might try to set off all that wildfire just to punish all those people who mistreated her, who let this happen to her and to her son, to burn those worthless King Landing small folk that laughed at her, made fun of her, and threw things at her when she was walking naked through the city, and to eradicate all those dirty sparrows coming in here and taking control of the city. So if that happens, then what about the last part of Maggie the Frog's prophecy? What about the Valonqar, the little brother who would wrap his hands around Cersei's throat and squeeze the life out of her? She thought this whole time that it would be Tyrion. But let's think of some other little brothers. Jaime is technically her little brother as well. He's, what, 2 minutes younger than Cersei, who came out first from the womb? If Cersei did this and set fire to King's Landing with wildfire, I would not see it out of the realm of possibility that Jaime kills her in retaliation. Maybe strangling her with a golden hand, the way that Tyrion's golden hand necklace strangled Shae, who he loved, but killed. Jaime could mirror that by murdering Cersei, who he loves, with his golden hand. The show likes to do things in twos, weddings, deaths, all kinds of mirroring events, so this would not be out of the realm of possibility and would be fascinating to see unfold. You know, the person who Cersei is most scared of for the longest time here, Tyrion, may not be the person she needed to fear this whole time at all. And her actions may have created the self-fulfilling prophecy that was originally predicted by Maggie the Frog, the Woods Witch. So this is a big, big freaking mess. And who knows what's going to happen. I don't think the Faith is going to end up killing Cersei. Something's going to happen before that. And it's going to be somebody who has more of a stake in the situation that ends up taking out Cersei. Because Cersei's not, she's not going to make it to the end of this thing, to this song of ice and fire. There's no way. I'd be very surprised. But, I mean, who knows? Does Jaime kill Cersei in the end? Is the Valonqar Jaime himself? who Cersei would never even think to fear. That would be an ironic twist of fate. And I mentioned it briefly, but it's worth mentioning quickly again that, yes, trial by combat has now been outlawed in Westeros as a whole. Now, this is interesting because I had suspected for a while that the High Sparrow would do something to undermine Cersei's trial by combat. I didn't know if it would be to disqualify the Mountain as a candidate because he is an undead abomination. That's kind of what I had been leaning towards, that he would be removed from the Kingsguard and locked up, or, you know, they would try to do this at least. But turns out like the High Sparrow has gone a step further. Oh, I also had, you know, speculated, or I'd heard speculation that the High Sparrow would, instead of doing a normal trial by combat, he would initiate a trial by seven, like in the Duncan Egg novels, where instead of a traditional trial by combat, it's more of an old school multi-man combat, like a team combat that involves seven representatives for each side of the quarrel, the defendant and the plaintiff, essentially. So each team consists of seven people who battle to the death, and the survivors are the winner of the trial of seven. So that would have been another interesting possibility, but that would have been big, you know, in terms of budget for the show. So looks like the High Sparrow has gone another way and convinced Tommen to outlaw trial by combat entirely. Interestingly, when Tommen said this in his proclamation, he said that after much consideration and prayer, the crown has decided to outlaw trial by combat. That seems to imply that it was his own decision, but I don't think we can really trust Tommen to be making any decisions on his own. It seems like everything that he does is triggered by somebody else, so we can pretty much guarantee that this is the High Sparrow's doing as well. But interesting development, and it'll be interesting to see how it turns out. Looks like there will not be any Clegane Bowl, at least not in the trial by combat. So, holy shit. Revelations. Now, there's one more thing worth mentioning. As Brienne and Pod escape from River Run, Jaime's up on the battlements and he sees them rowing away. And he waves his golden hand at them and they wave back. And I've heard speculation that this may be foreshadowing that one of those two in the boat, either Brienne or Podrick, may end up being the end of Jaime and killing him. I mean, this is speculated simply because he let them go and didn't try to stop them. And that means that that decision could end up biting him in the ass eventually. So let's be on the watch for that. I really hope that that Brienne doesn't have to kill Jaime. Rather see them fuck than fight, like Bronn had talked about in the episode. That was pretty funny. But, yeah. Yeah, I hope that doesn't happen. Don't kill him, Brienne! So, that pretty much wraps up the book crossovers for Season 6, Episode 8, No One. And now I have a listener's question to go over with you guys. Favo says on Facebook, Duncan, do you take requests? Your discussion of the Valyrian steel swords has me wondering where they are now, how they got there, and who has them. Like, what happened to Lightbringer? We know Ned Stark's got split into two. Would just love to know where they are as winter is coming and the Night King. So, let's talk a little bit about Valyrian steel and Lightbringer. So, Valyrian steel is a compound forged in the time of ancient Valyria. It's folded and folded like steel thousands of times and ends up with a dark rippling pattern across the steel. And overall, there may just be hundreds of Valyrian steel blades left in the entire Planetos, with just a couple dozen remaining in Westeros, if I remember correctly. And let's see, I have a list here of Valyrian steel weapons that are known to exist or have existed in recent Westerosi history. We have Blackfyre, the ancestral sword of House Targaryen, once wielded by Aegon the Conqueror himself during the conquest and of the Seven Kingdoms. It was passed down generation by generation through the Targaryen kings until, I believe, Aegon the Fourth, Aegon the Unworthy, gave it to a bastard son of his instead of his trueborn son because he, for political reasons, and the blade ended up being lost during the resulting Blackfyre Rebellion, which was started because of this occurrence, giving the sword, Blackfyre, to a bastard son who then attempted to claim the kingship because he was the holder of the Valyrian steel sword, Blackfyre. There's another Valyrian steel dark longsword of House Targaryen which was owned by Visenya Targaryen, one of the sisters of Aegon the Conqueror. It was known as Dark Sister. It was also lost during the Blackfyre Rebellion. There's, of course, Ice, Ned Stark's famous greatsword, passed down for generations and generations from House Stark. We have, that was turned into Oathkeeper and Widow's Wail. There's Longclaw, the ancestral sword of House Mormont. Bright Roar, the ancestral sword of House Lannister, lost by King Tommen II Lannister when on his expedition to Valyria, hundreds of years ago. I believe Tyrion's uncle actually attempted to go back to Valyria to reclaim this sword and never returned, only adding credence to the concept that those who go back to ancient Valyria are lost in the fire and cannot return. It's just not a safe place to travel. There's also Heartsbane, which we saw a couple episodes ago, which is the ancestral sword of House Tully. There's Lady Forlorn, the ancestral sword of House Corbray. And there is the dagger wielded by the assassin who attempted to kill Bran Stark after he had survived his fall from the window. Another blade that may or may not be included in this list would be Dawn, the ancestral sword of House Dane, which is thousands of years old and has been passed down through the generations to members of House Dane, which members, family members who are worthy of holding the title Sword of the Morning. Only Danes that are Sword of the Mornings are granted Dawn as their blade, which is a very noble title and is only given to those who really are exceptional warriors and exceptional knights. And that brings us to our theory of Dawn, which may actually be the original Lightbringer wielded by the last hero during the last long night. So this blade, Dawn, owned by House Dane, is supposedly forged from the heart of a fallen star. That's important to remember. There are certain other things, including that, which make Dawn a likely candidate for being the original Lightbringer. So I'll read you a couple little passages here about Lightbringer. Darkness lay over the world, and a hero, Azor Ahai, was chosen to fight against it. To fight the darkness, Azor Ahai needed to forge a hero's sword. He labored for 30 days and 30 nights until it was done. However, when he went to temper it in water, the sword broke. He was not one to give up easily, so he started over. The second time, he took 50 days and 50 nights to make the sword, even better than the first. To attempt it this time, he captured a lion and drove the sword into its heart. But once more, the steel shattered. The third time, with a heavy heart, for he knew beforehand what he must do to finish the blade, he worked for 100 days and nights until it was finished. This time he called for his wife, Nissa Nissa, and asked her to bare her breast. He drove his sword into her breast, her soul combining with the steel of the sword, creating Lightbringer. There are certain linguistic tells that it seemed to indicate Dawn potentially being related to the Long Night and potentially being Lightbringer. For instance, when light is brought at the end of the night, what is that called? It's called the Dawn. So, Lightbringer may have been the sword used to bring the Dawn, and at the end, when the light was there, the sword may have been renamed Dawn because it no longer needed to bring the light. The light had been brought, so for some reason, the name may have been changed. Also, there's speculation that the wife of Azor Ahai, Nissa Nissa, may have been an ancient member of House Dane. In this way, if the blade of Lightbringer was tempered by being thrust through her heart, it would have been tempered by being forged from the heart of a fallen star, because the sigil of Dane, of House Dane, includes a falling star. So if the sword was created by using a member of this house, then it would have been made from a falling star, you know, because people from houses are often equated with their sigils. Starks are referred to as wolves, Lannisters are referred to as lions, Danes are referred to as stars. So it is entirely possible that Dawn may in fact be Lightbringer, and the Sword of the Morning, interesting name as well, the wielder of the blade, Dawn, that may be a title for someone who is essentially a placeholder, meant to protect Dawn until it's needed again by the next Azor Ahai. So it could have been passed down through generation and generation, being carried by these certain exceptional warriors known as the Sword of the Morning, to protect this sword, which really would be, if it's Lightbringer, it would be the Sword of the Morning, the sword that brought the morning, brought the light, brought the dawn. And something else interesting about Dawn, it's got a unique white blade that's unknown compared to any other sword in the Seven Kingdoms. People have, you know, taken the fallen star thing literally and thought that the blade might be forged from a piece of a star. But as we know, Lightbringer was famous as being a flaming sword. So I think it's possible that it could have been some type of Valyrian steel, maybe infused with dragon glass or something like that, and that the burning nature of the sword may have turned the steel white over years and years of being aflame, which could have resulted in this unique, anomalous white blade that we're told Dawn has. And it's kind of interesting to note that if Dawn is Lightbringer, and if the Sword of the Morning is basically someone who protects this sword, waiting for Azor Ahai to be reborn and to reclaim this when it's needed, is it just a coincidence that the last Sword of the Morning, Arthur Dane, dies at the Tower of Joy, as the potential new Azor Ahai, Jon Snow, is being born at that exact moment? And following that Ned Stark had both of them in his possession, he left the Tower of Joy with Jon Snow and with Dawn, if R plus L equals J is true. So what are the odds of that? The most recent Sword of the Morning dying right as the new Azor Ahai is being born. And Azor Ahai is basically born alongside of Dawn as Ned brings Dawn back to the castle of the House Dane. What's it called? Evenfall? Or Starfall, I think it is. Yeah, so that's an interesting coincidence that may, you know, be telling that Dawn could be the original Lightbringer. Other people have suggested that Lightbringer may be under Winterfell for some reason, that the castle may have been built there to mark the place where the Long Night fell, where winter fell to the light. That could mean something too. Who knows? There are so many possibilities. We'll just have to wait and find out. But there's lots more information on Valyrian steel out there. There's more theories about Lightbringer and about all this. I just don't have time to go into all of it right now without driving Jason and Mr. Blog completely out of their minds. So I should probably cut this bad boy short, and hopefully you are intrigued enough, listeners, to go do some more research on your own and find out as much as you can about this. I would be fascinated to hear any ideas you have relating to Valyrian steel or as to Lightbringer, where it may be, if we've seen it already in the story, if it needs to be reforged, you know, any of that. So feel free to write in with any questions or any information you guys may have. And that pretty much wraps this up. This has been Season 6, Episode 8, No One, coverage in the Still Smug Book Talk section of Game of Microphones. I'm your host, Sir Duncan the Fearsome, Lord of Castle Sterling, and bearer of the Valyrian Steel Greatsword Dark Warrior. And I hope you guys have a great week.
At Humana, our Medicare Advantage plans give you coverage and care you can count on, along with guided support to help you feel your best. You could have a plan with a $0 premium or an all-in-one plan that may include medical and prescription coverage, as well as routine dental, vision, and hearing. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal. The Humana Honor Medicare Advantage Plan gives you $1,860 back each year in your Social Security check. Choose coverage that helps you keep more money in your pocket. Learn more at GetHumana.com. Humana, a more human way to healthcare. The Part B Give Back benefit pays part or all of your Part B premium, and the amount may change based on the amount you pay for Part B. Limitations and restrictions may apply. Humana is a Medicare Advantage HMO and PPO organization with a Medicare contract. Enrollment in any Humana plan depends on contract renewal.